So,
I have a problem.
To take this down,
Houston,
we do have a problem, but like all good scientists and creative thinkers, we're going to figure out a way around it. They used to do these tests with NASA rocket scientists. They put them in a room and tell them to like fit a square cube into like a little circular, you know, circular hole, and give them like, you know, half an hour to figure it out, like a few tubes and stuff, and they would do it. So sometimes we got to be nonlinear now.
Okay.
For those who don't know what I'm talking about, my PowerPoint is not compatible with the software on this computer. And since we don't have the internet, I can't download an application. And so what I'm going to try my best to do is speak in a more visual way than I would normally do, such that you guys can hopefully have a picture painted in your mind of what a cool PowerPoint presentation would look like.
Okay.
Yes, Phil. Yeah.
I would like to notify something about all these elements. What happened in Soviet Union by Mendeleev and the other scientists? Hmm? All these 200 or 300 years.
Mm-hmm.
I talking in Moscow, 1970. When I joined international conference with UNICEF about vocational training and unvocational training, I told them and declare the educational system in Soviet Union damaged the personality of the student. 1970, what happened 1991? All Soviet Union fall down. Where is Mendeleev? And all these elements, what happened?
Well, that's our job, is to recreate the Mendeleevs immediately, right?
We need
to
discover the point of contact. We need it any developing country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What is this, the point of contact? We need it.
Right. I think it would be very interesting. I found it funny when Bob and I were working on this class. We observed some of Mendeleev's work as a political organizer in Russia. And it's interesting to read some of his writings, because he was also the head of the committee for the protective tariff in Russia. And he has this really excellent protective tariff, right? He's bringing the American system into Russia. And he's got a great...
Hold
on. Let me finish. Now, he's got a great attack on the free trade system of Britain. And in it, it's a really great little article where he's attacking, pointing out that yes, it's an interesting model, it's an interesting theory, this free trade system, but just like phlogiston, which was the alchemical false element that was supposed to exist for all of the years before Lavoisier, this element that people assumed existed when metal rusts, right? And everyone said, well, since metal rusts, it looks like there's less of it, so whatever this phlogiston, this magical mystery thing is, it must be leaving the metal. And everyone knew that this stuff must exist, but they couldn't find this phlogiston. And Mendeleev says, well, just like this phlogiston, it was an interesting theory while it lasted, but it's been completely disproven by reality. And just like phlogiston was thrown in the garbage, so should free trade. And he really emphasizes a lot this conception of the development, the necessity to develop the political and educational freedom of the population in order to have a sovereign nation. And he understands the enemy very well. He understands the role of the British financial system in an exemplary way, and so does Vernadsky. And so I think this is a lot of the currents that are currently in Russia that are somewhat rational, that made LaRouche a member of the Russian Academy of Sciences in the 1990s when LaRouche was brought out of prison. These are the currents that we have to really tap into, as well as those in other nations, but it's this cultural heritage that these nations have as a reflex towards fighting for science, for development, and for this idea of the American system.
That is so important, mm-hmm. to discover this point of contact. We need it.
Yeah.
What is this?
What do you mean by point of contact?
We need all these elements around us. Anywhere we are going, we find Mendeleev elements. Okay?
Right.
We find water, air, oxygen, anything around us, but we don't touch these elements at all in any developing country. Why?
To prevent them to develop their minds.
Let's have the discussion, because I'm about to give a class and I'm going to try to go quickly. I'm going to keep it within hopefully 45 minutes or so, and then maybe we could break for a discussion. But But this is a that's an important discussion.
Mr. Eiko said, we need the mental power.
Yeah, correct.
We can discover this.
Are you asking me? Or is
yes, I ask you.
All right, well, hopefully we'll have an idea of that. What LaRouche challenged everyone here is he put forth this challenge for not just the policymakers, but also for our movement to really bring a return to the paradoxes that were left behind at the turn of the century when all these breakthroughs were being made in the realms of chemistry, in the realms of electromagnetism, in the realms of living noetic processes. And the problem that we have today is these are all schismed into these, you know, these various fields by themselves. What we have to do now is to see, well, what role does a true unified field theory play in a reorganization of the global economy as a flank, right? Because as it stands, we're on the verge of, we see what's happening internationally, right? We've got hyperinflation around the corner. We've got an imperial cartel of the British Empire moving to impose new feudal controls on the global economy. And the flank by which we're coming from here is from the standpoint of ideas, that we know, unlike most people, we have a true understanding that human society and economy is not money, which is what drives most people's day-to-day lives here. What the reality is the capacity for the human species to become more and more in tune by virtue of these Mendeleevs, these Einsteins, with the universe as a whole. And the byproduct is an upgrade in the quality of life, the quantity of people you can support, and an increase of freedom, not of just action and your capacity to master nature, but also an increased freedom to make more discoveries. And that's really the essence of economics. And this is what we have to reintroduce, because Mendeleev understood this very well. And so did people like Franklin Roosevelt. And so from the vantage point that I'm going to take this class, where Bob, I think, really well brought up this evolution of our conception of the material domain in which we were born, I'm going to look a little bit more at the vantage point of electromagnetism, life, and cosmic radiation. Now, my original intention in performing my part of the class here was, because these are all a one, right? We're living in a single universe, like Bob was saying. And my original intention was to focus much more on cosmic radiation than I'm going to in the course of my presentation today. We know it's one of the most underestimated fields of thought and exploration that is currently on the frontier of science that, you know, proposes to unlock questions like the cures for cancer, other diseases that we're currently not even thinking about, life, habitation in space, questions like just evolution in general. And there's a direct interconnectedness that we can know just straight from something like as simple as carbon-14, which is a radioactive isotope which exists in all living organisms. All of us contain a lot of carbon-14. Now, carbon-14 is also going through constant radioactive disintegrations in our bodies. And don't be scared, that's not a bad thing. That's actually, if that wasn't doing that, we would all be dead, and there would not be life. Now, there's about 4,000 of those things happening every second. Carbon-14 is also what a lot of, you guys have heard of this probably in terms of archaeology, right? When people want to know how old a fossil is, a living thing, they'll use a carbon dating technique to see what is the half-life, to what degree has it decayed into its, you know, half its element, into lead. And where does carbon-14 come from but cosmic radiation? This is something which combines with nitrogen in the upper atmosphere of the planet as fast-spinning hydrogen nuclei slam into nitrogen, nitrogen-14, creating carbon-14. Now, knowing that that is a principal integral to life, and if it did not occur, if those cosmic rays were not bombarding it, this nitrogen, we would not have the preconditions for life. We already know, straight off the bat, this is vital. Now, there's many other unexplored venues of thought that I'm going to, by the end, at least bring up in summary form, maybe not provide the absolute solution to a lot of these questions, but at least bring back the questions such that we as a species can begin to address them rather than devote our attention to false priorities like climate science, how to stop carbon emissions, to fight false phenomena that aren't really occurring, or bail out banks and think about new ways of creating a new financial instrument that will allow us to bail out a bank, which is where, sadly, most of I wouldn't want to call it genius, but intelligence is being invested in right now. And so, a lot of you may already know this, some of you don't, but the key flank that LaRouche has proposed internationally, not just in saving the NASA's program, which Obama has already made commitments to dismantle, but also for other nations that are going towards space, is LaRouche said that what we need to do is commit ourselves as a community of sovereign nations, founding this new Bretton Woods monetary conference, this new monetary system that must occur very soon. We have to commit ourselves to a physical, statistical impossibility, but that's completely necessary for the survival of the human species, which is putting a human being on Mars safely and bringing them back within the next 50 years. The reason why this is such a vital and revolutionary challenge is it puts all of the not just optimism of society, which is currently very much lacking, and especially the youth generation, back into the fore, thinking about what is the life going to be for my future and my grandchildren's future. But also, it poses problems that we need vitally to just basically meet challenges on Earth today, like our fresh water crisis or educational crisis. And things like fusion energy, which if you're going to be serious about putting a human being, a living organism, on Mars, under the current conditions, without fusion rockets, without the development and application of fusion technologies, that person's going to get there completely muscle atrophied, bones melted, and not very functional. Because you need, for 300 days under current technology, you're going to be in space, chemical rockets, and that's another 300 days back. We know the gravity on Mars is one-third that it is on Earth. We don't know what the effects of that is going to be on life. Food. How are we going to grow food outside of the biosphere? And so getting fusion rockets isn't just a way to get there quicker to make more money on your space tours or something the Obama plan has it. But it's really not that Obama is planning to build fusion rockets, but the idea of just creating a space tourism. But if and when we do accomplish this, because I think it is a certain necessity that it will occur, our capacity to get there will be brought down to about 3 to 4 days, moving at speeds that we've only seen coming out of, at least in matter, coming out of cosmic rays and particles that move at relative speeds close to that of light. And so this is the first time the human noetic process will have created the conditions whereby relativistic spaceflight will occur, and at that with biological organisms. So that means now overcoming certain big epistemological problems. A big one, and this is why I'm not going to talk about cosmic radiation as much as I had planned, is because a big one involves this idea that's sort of trapped mankind since Einstein's death. And the fight he was waging against the radical positivists of his day, which is this idea of a wave-particle duality in quantum physics. So today, if you take most physics courses anywhere in the world, you're going to be taught that, in general, the universe is fundamentally irrational. Sometimes you could look at things like light or electrons, and depending on how you look at them, they might behave like a wave. They might behave like a particle. And what this pertains to is a fight and a question that human beings have been working to resolve now for well over a few centuries. You could even say probably a few millennia, which is this idea of what can we know? Because if you start from the vantage point, everybody who's coming into this world trying to know what is either going to start with one of two hypotheses. That, one, there is an efficient existence to reality, and I just don't know it yet. that my mind is inadequate, is not tuned to that reality that exists, that has a self-evident, or not a self-evident, but has an efficient existence with qualities to it, or that nothing exists and everything I see is just my relative perception that's completely different from everybody else, and thus all I have to do is just live my life to prove that based on my relative perception and your relative perception, I see Dave looking smaller than JP sees Dave, thus size is all relative and matter doesn't, you know, there's no actual truth. And then you just live your life trying to disprove everything that people believe. So from the vantage point of that which actually bears fruit and produces progress in human society, the first hypothesis tends to be much more successful, which is that there is a reality, we just don't know it, and we have to develop a method of thinking that permits us to go outside of what we know and hypothesize ever more perfectly to come to understand it. And the two things that every human being has been able to sort of observe, as Bob went through with the periodic table, is that there are different states of matter. And fundamentally, the two phenomena that strike one most clearly are the material phenomena and the energetic. You've got the three basic states of matter, the gas, material, liquid, which all periodic elements will be able to transmit to depending on the heat that you apply and the conditions. You also have another state, this idea of this quality of fire, of a plasma in a certain sense, which has a more, you can't necessarily touch it and feel it in a physical way as you can for these other states of matter. So material energetic, and this does play into the wave particle question, since a wave does tend to take on the characteristic of energy. And particle, that's definitely a material idea. It's something sort of tangible in your mind, though you might not be able to see an electron. Now, most of human society, the only way we could distinguish how these things interact, because that's the big question, right, is how do these two phenomena, one that you can't necessarily touch, one that you can, how do these interact with each other, since they exist in the same universe? And we only had one small spectrum of the entire electromagnetic spectra, which is the visible light range, which is very small to work with. And that's like everything you guys are seeing right now in this room. All of the colors that you're catching are just different frequencies of what the human eye is in tune with. Now, up until very recently, that was all we had. And so you could observe certain things like, it was observed that there's refraction, there's diffraction when the light goes into water. Even the Greeks observed that it would reflect. There was a certain discovery of refraction, that it would bend at a certain angle later on. There was an idea that the light was coming, you could only know this because it was bouncing off an object and coming into your eye, so there's an idea of a directionality to this light, this energetic phenomenon. But that was pretty much the limitation for what we could hypothesize for the longest time. We had a similar idea. Oh, maybe, yeah.
If you need it.
Yeah, okay. We also had an additional conception with atoms that were organized by a principle called life. And it was observed as well that things like plant life did act in a certain way in accord with the sun. Flowers would blossom and then the buds would close during the nighttime. Even the human biological cycles, people observe that when the sun goes down, I get sleepy. And there's a certain... That observation allows one to hypothesize. And you could probably imagine an early thinker trying to eliminate what it would be that would be causing this living reaction that rocks don't do, right? And you could think, well, what do you observe coming out of the sunlight? Well, you got light, different frequencies depending on the time of day, right? Different intensity. You've got heat. Okay, that's pretty much probably about it that you can directly observe, light and heat. And if you were an experimenter, you might actually take a flower then and say, well, I'm going to create the conditions outside of the sun, maybe with a fire, of light and heat, and see what it does, right? Does the flower respond in the same way? And sure enough, there's something absent in a firelight, even though it supplies both light and heat, that plant life will not respond to. Not in that same way. So there's something else unseen that the mind needs to capture, but that is not directly accessible by the senses. keep it in mind here. We're in a world today, just to reemphasize, that's completely embraced by this idea of empiricism. This idea that all your mind knows is what your senses can tell you. And since the mind is the substance of the mind is simply the five senses, thus, like your common stock market analyst or, you know, free trader on Wall Street or whomever, your only job really is to try to use your senses to best manipulate and navigate the world to get the most pleasure and avoid the most pain, irregardless of any type of moral repercussions. What are the consequences of your actions? Well, whatever. That's, what, are you doing bad to others by virtue of your creation of credit default swaps or, you know, derivatives? No, you're just doing your job. I mean, that's, you wouldn't have gotten a diploma if that wasn't the case. And besides, what's good for you is different from what's good for somebody else. Right? Maybe killing Africans dying is bad for them, but hey, if we make money off it, so be it, right? So this is a very important ideology which has infested our society like a virus, and it's really at the heart of what we have to attack right now if we're going to get across a serious solution to this economic collapse. And there are solutions, but people have to break with very closely held beliefs, monetarism being the big one. But this idea of the wave-particle duality, Einstein was trying to fight it, this is a big one too. So you look at what was occurring around that span where Bob was discussing of the lifespan of Mendeleev, and the layers of freedom that were being opened up wide for human beings was astounding. Now, this is not a completely accurate representation. I apologize. But that thing I was telling you about visible light, about, I think, what is it, Bob? About 600 to 1,000...
400 to 700. Billionths of a meter.
Billionths of a meter? Yeah. So that's a very small range of the frequency spectrum that we could know about. That's what we could access the world by. Since then, we've discovered that we have things like infrared frequencies that are much more closely related to heat that are bombarding us all the time. We've got things like microwaves. Right? We've got AM, we've got longer range radio waves passing through us at all seconds, at all times of the day. If you get into higher frequencies beyond what we can even sense, you find yourself sitting right in the world of ultraviolet radiation, which was a necessary discovery for people to fully understand what actually was this active agent that was most active when plants were producing chlorophyll. What was it that they enjoyed coming out of that sun that helped them survive and produce that stuff that we need so well to live, like oxygen? Later on, you had Becquerel, at a very close date after ultraviolet light was discovered out of some plasma experiments. You had X-rays then discovered in a similar way. You had gamma rays. And the question now is, I mean, is there anything beyond that that we've still yet to detect? I wouldn't know what to say about that. We have this whole now, in the past 140 some odd years, you have this whole new domain of freedom now to think and to also control. Since when we discover something like an X-ray, all of a sudden, we didn't just discover it's self-evident, its existence, but now we were capable, like Henri Becquerel, as soon as he discovered it, after not eating for like 2 weeks, basically just got his wife's hand in there to actually see if it did do what he thought it did, and it indeed, you know, got her, you know, you could see right through her hand. And she said, like, oh, I've seen death. But they used it almost a month later to take the first bullet out of a child's leg who had gotten shot. Now, you can see that if you have, at that point, think of the political context that you're in. You have Lincoln's American system just beat out the British slave system that was being adopted all over the world in the 1870s, 1880s, not just in Russia, but in you know, France and Germany, in Japan. It was being exported all around the world as nations were all realizing, holy shit, we can be sovereign. Like, we don't have to be submissive to an imperial financial cartel. Like, we can actually develop ourselves. So you had a certain political system in place where discoveries like X-ray technology could, as quickly as possible, be integrated immediately into the transforming the quality of lives of the doctors, of the educational system, and immediately alleviate things like your shit life expectancy of 40 years of age if you were in Canada in 1890 to immediately, you know, 50, 60. So you had to have that immediate, that constant integration of the discoveries made in the minds of individuals into transforming the technological basis of society as a whole as quickly as possible. You don't want to, you know, wait for some for that to be become profitable, because it's been proven historically that if you were more concerned about profit, that would never occur. You just stick with what you already had, because, you know, why cure diseases when you could just like make money off the symptoms? So there's a different conception which is really vital to really get across. Now, I'll take a little segue, because I want people to get a certain sense in their minds of what light actually is. Since, I mean, I know before I started thinking about this, I found it a very confusing concept. You know, here you got it coming out of, you know, fluorescent lights, you got it coming out of the sun, you got it coming out of light bulbs, fire. It seems to have a certain qualities that it goes hand in hand with heat, right? Sometimes, unless it's by an electrical charge and an ionized gas like we have in these things, then all of a sudden there's no heat. So you got these qualities to it, and everyone says, well, you know, Stephen Hawking, it's sometimes it's like a little hard balls just shooting out. Sometimes it's like a wave. But how do you think about that? So I'm going to try to go through maybe just a few of the key discoveries made by a couple of the key players and individuals in history regarding this question, to paint a quick picture summarily in our minds. But on your own, I mean, this is stuff that you'll want to flesh out more subjectively. People like Da Vinci, people like Huygens, Fermat, Thomas Young, and you can name others, were following a school of thought going back to Plato. And you could read their writings, and indeed you'll find that this common method and self-conscious positioning of one's own identity as a scientist and as a political leader within the continuity of this fight historically from Greece, based on a Platonic method of dialectic, in opposition and with this conception that the mind can come to know what is beyond its limitations. These people were those who are today, they're paid lip service to for having made the breakthroughs in light as a wave, right? But oftentimes people are like, in, you know, we're very much discouraged from actually reading the original writings or seeing the original discoveries to encounter what paradoxes they were themselves encountering and how they were hypothesizing, which I'm going to get across now, I'm going to try to. One of the proof that these folks that I just mentioned brought forth, who were, again, defenders of Kepler, Leibniz, was that it could be observed that light was not just a wave. Like, Da Vinci even put out proofs that it behaved like a wave. But it, not just any wave, that it was actually a spherical wave. So one of the proofs that Da Vinci also presented in some of his notebooks were the observation that if you put a candle in a dark room, you're going to find a certain type of effect where this light is going out in all directions, but there's a certain spherical sort of, I guess you could say a certain spherical motion happening. Whereas if you were, you know, standing five people around in a circle and all were at the same distance from that light, you would see it with the same intensity. You would feel the same quality of heat. And if you took another five steps back, everybody at the same five steps, that light, that candle, would now be just as less intense for everybody, and the heat would be just as less. They would be sensing with their, you know, measuring devices of some sort. And you can include that for people all around it, if you could imagine a whole sphere around it, not just on the circular level, you know? And this introduces also an idea of, ironically, energy flux density. Because if you could imagine like a certain square or a square centimeter on the surface of that sphere when it was very close to the light, and take that same sphere or that same square centimeter on the sphere when it's 5 feet away, you're going to find that the intensity is much less, it's much more dispersed. There's much less heat acting on the same surface further away, right? Mm-hmm. So now if you were imagining the human economy applying now heat to a form of work to your machine tool to accomplish work, then there would be much less work being accomplished from that little cube or that little squared centimeter that was far away relative to the one that was much closer. So LaRouche puts a lot of emphasis on really investigating questions like spherical geometry for this reason. And Thomas Young put out a very famous, almost 200 years later, in 1802-ish, thereabouts, he put out a very famous experiment, which you can even do in the comfort of your own home with a little laser beam and a baseball card, called the double slit experiment. We're taking just basic sunlight, right? So I'm just going to set one panel with a little slit in it, another panel with two slits in it, and a board at the end, like a wall. And what one can observe, I'm sure I do this as best that I can. Right. Keeping in mind our spherical wave pattern then flowing through. Based upon that one wave that we began with, as its vibrations hit the two slits, you get two waves which end up forming crests and troughs. Where they hit on this last surface, everywhere the crests have, and I didn't do this so well, so it's hard to illustrate, but wherever the crests have canceled each other out, you get a dark shadow, and everywhere they coincide, they reinforce each other, and you get a little light, such that the effect that you end up sort of seeing on the wall is something similar to this. If you can imagine little lights and shadows in between. That's a good proof. So lights a wave. Who thought it was with all of that though? How people still thought it was a particle, little hard balls, is really hard to believe. But really, there was a big fight. This stirred a lot of shit up. Because Newton said, light is little hard balls, infinitely, coming out of everything from fire to you name it. So did Descartes. And, you know, they are religious, religious cult leaders, so you have to defend your God when they say that, you know, something behaves one way, even though all reason tells you it's opposite. and this was a big point of contention, a big fight. The implications of this discovery, along with others by people like Ole Romer, who discovered that light is finite, it's not traveling at infinite speeds using the moons of Jupiter, were a new conception, not just of light, but of the universe and of the substance that it's traveling through. What is this idea of matter? What is this idea of space? What is even the time that it transpires? Right? That there's a finiteness to it. That there's a quality to it. And it doesn't exist by itself. It has other phenomena that it coexists with. So this conception produced this idea of fields in a certain sense, was what you're dealing with when you're dealing with spherical wavefronts, as well as anything from the electromagnetic spectrum, is directly fields. Since all aspects, it's not just the visible light that behaves this way, right? All aspects of the electromagnetic spectrum, all the way from AM radio to gamma rays, also behaves in spherical wave patterns. So you have fields being emitted with certain qualities at certain rates of change that are directly knowable. And thanks to Kepler, we could know that it was in accordance with the inverse square law that the intensity is diminishing from the source that's emitting this light or even sound, which is another sort of thing we could go into later. you had a conception of a finite, not an infiniteness, and an idea that space wasn't actually empty. Maybe the heads of Newton and Descartes might have been a little empty and a little bit of light was taking place too much in their heads than it was in their minds. Forget it. So, can I elaborate on what I just said about Newton and Descartes?
About the empty space.
Well, they believe that there was a self-evident absolute extended space, which is completely empty, an absolute extended time, completely devoid of any, you know, that's it. Just it's absolute extension, no qualities, no shape. And that was necessary for their systems to function. But the key is that this was just like today's conception that money is economics, not the physical economy. It's the same battle. They were part of, keep in mind, like, who is Newton, right? Treasurer of the Mint, total British puppet. He had a political agenda as well as anybody. And the, what was I going to say? I lost my train of thought.
British puppet?
Yeah, I know about that. Thank you. But, right, their systems were based on this idea that mathematics, it's not physics, right? Mathematics is primary. The physical universe, you must assume, must take on the form of what your mathematical equations say. So regardless of what reality says otherwise, your mathematical equations say this. That comes first. Right? It doesn't matter what the reality says that the physical economy is. Your derivatives have a certain formula, a certain Black-Scholes formula that says that they're worth a certain amount of money. And who cares about the reality of hyperinflation? It's the money that matters. Who cares about people needing food and infrastructure, right? So it's the exact same issue that was being waged and being dismantled by, you know, people like Leibniz, who were just taking down this entire argument. People like Thelma, Huygens, Leibniz, Young. Now, today, for some reason, there's a certain ballless conciliation that was made, where most people will say in physics today that both were right. Both Huygens, both the wave theory, they were correct, and Newton, he was correct too. How the hell did that happen? So, I wish I had my slides. This would be so much easier. But that brings us to the fight that was being waged by those followers of not just Mendeleev, but specifically of Riemann and this Keplerian method. Like Max Planck, Albert Einstein, Vladimir Vernadsky, and a lesser known, but I think equally important among the branch of early scientists living in the same period, was another, not Russian, I think Ukrainian scientist named Alexander Gervich. Ukrainian, right?
Yeah.
Ukrainian. I'm going to focus just on the discoveries being made at the turn of the century by, well, you can call it the quantum revolution, where Max Planck specifically led the way in discovering a certain interesting and paradoxical quality of light and heat as he was investigating something called black body radiation, which you can go online and Google it. But what he fundamentally observed was that as the intensity of power is increased to a certain black body, and you could imagine something like your kitchen heating element, the power increases, and as it does so, the heat and also the spectra of light increases at a connected rate, you know? So you'll find that even though you're feeling heat, you're not seeing light because only a little bit of energy is going through your heating element. But if you had infrared goggles, you'd see it, you know, blaring with light. So you go through, there's a certain infrared, you know, reddish, yellow, white, hot, and all matter actually you'll find can go through this. Any matter when heated can become up to blue hot. And what Max Planck observed was that there were, as you increase the power, you could increase it and increase the heat to a certain point, and you would get a corresponding amount of emission coming out of this black body, a certain amount of color and heat coming out of it, but you would keep turning up that power, and that frequency spectra that was being released from the black body was not increasing. And at a certain point, you could reach a certain threshold where what blew everyone's mind was that it didn't just go gradually up to the new spectra level. It didn't go up. It didn't go up to the new frequency. It made like a leap. So you apply the heat, and all of a sudden, to a certain point, there's no nothing. All of a sudden, bam! Now you're at a new frequency level, a new frequency of light is being emitted from the black body, right? And you do it again, and you keep on raising the power, increasing it, increasing it, nothing happened, then all of a sudden you hit a threshold level, bam, you're at a new level. And so this allowed Planck to take the hypothesis that what was occurring here was that unlike the assumption that light was just a continuous flow, right, that it was just being emitted like water through a drainage pipe, you know, there was actually a certain discreteness to it, a certain quantization occurring within the light, that it wasn't just a continuous process. And so this is what, I mean, he had theories that I haven't really looked at too much, but postulating the existence of what he called harmonic oscillators. But what's for sure is that he didn't believe that it was just chaos. What he was seeking was, what is the harmonic ordering of what generates these quantized light emissions? Just like Kepler was asking, what is the harmonic ordering determining these orbitals of the planets? Now, the relationship of that, already you have an idea of light's matter again interacting in a new way. What Einstein discovered almost a couple years later in 1905 was a very important discovery bearing upon light's interaction with electrons. And using this is fundamentally where this current idea of lights both behaving like a wave and a particle tends to come from.
Now, who made that discovery?
Einstein. It's called the photoelectric effect. Now, what he observed was that by applying, and it had already been observed, but Einstein was the guy who reconciled how to resolve the problem. But it had been observed that, and keep in mind, electrons were just being discovered already maybe 15 years earlier. It wasn't a long time that this was known. But as light is hitting, right, as light hits any metallic plate, what can be observed is that, well, if the light is a very low frequency, like let's say radio, microwaves, or infrared, yeah, not much happens. Nothing really occurs. It just bounces right off. You get a reflection. At a certain point, you increase the intensity of the light, and what occurs is that based on the frequency of the light, which is the rate of the waves over a period of time, that's what we're dealing with, frequency, is that all of a sudden you start finding electrons bouncing off the plate. Right? And the electrons have a corresponding frequency to the light being emitted. And as you increase it, all of a sudden more electrons start popping off, right? And that's pretty mind-blowing, because this produces a direct conception of an idea of a photon, huh. Right? That there's little quantized packets of light striking electrons. Those electrons now respond directly by being shot off, and you could, in a certain sense, measure the rate of quanta emissions from almost anything. So that's pretty interesting. Now, here's the problem. The thinkers of the British Empire, the hardcore radical empiricists, those guys I mentioned, the Newtonians, who at that point, you know, you had different cells, different sects called the Ernst Mach Society, the Vienna Circle. These guys really didn't like that, because these discoveries completely overturned their closed systems, their beautiful closed models that they got their careers out of, you know. And one of the biggest attacks on these discoveries in nuclear science was occurring out of what's called today, or it was called then, but today it's what's hegemonically taught, was the Copenhagen School, or the Copenhagen interpretation. So that's actually what we are taught today is quantum mechanics. It's people reinterpreting through the filter of the Copenhagen interpretation the discoveries of Max Planck, Einstein, and others. And who are these guys? These are Heisenberg, this is Bohr. This is the circles who basically said, all we can know is what we can model. All we can model is what we can touch directly. We can have direct sensory experience thereof. And these guys basically said, well, based on the fact that sometimes when you look at a wave, and we're just trying to touch it, we just want to like see it. We want to know its momentum, and we want to know its position of one of these photons. We know they're occurring. We just want to catch both momentum and the position. And what they found was that every time they try and touch it, they can get the position of it, right? Because all of a sudden you find like a little apparatus that can like measure where the photon is going to be at a certain point in time. So they can see where it is, but the act of seeing it stops it or deflects it from its journey from, let's say, from the light to the wall, right? So now you don't get the momentum. Or you can get the momentum. If you don't want to like look directly at the individual photon, you can sort of measure when you turn on the light and when it hit the wall, and you can get a certain relative idea of the momentum of the photon. But you can't get the position then. You got to give up on trying to like do that. So this is based on the fact that I can't do that, that it's impossible to just touch that light, since light has to bounce off the light to reach my eye, and that fucks up everything. And we want this objective description of what's occurring, completely detached from us actually looking at it. We want, you know, because obviously human beings and the mind is something not very part of, it's not part of the universe. That's some like accidental epiphenomena. Whereas there's the universe and all of its laws that's deterministic, and then there's us and our minds, and then, you know, we have all of these indeterministic qualities like emotions and, you know, intuition and stuff. That's like for the artists. That's not for the scientists. So these guys were, they basically said, okay, well, all we can do then is use statistic models. We can create a probability theory model describing where something is probably going to be, where a photon is probably going to be in the immediate future ahead. And we can forecast its probability. And we'll accept that sometimes it'll behave like a wave and sometimes it'll behave like a particle. And we'll use this method, not looking for what people like Einstein or Planck were looking for, which is a higher harmonic process governing the singularities or these discrete motions. We're not going to do that anymore. We're just going to stick with the motions, forget about the higher process. And that's generally what took over. You know, if you look at how an economist is trained these days, it's not looking at the higher process of what's governing the physical preconditions of a human economy. You know, it's literally looking moment to moment, second to second, what are the forecasts of the fluctuations of the market going to be? All right, this is what really took over, especially in the 80s. But also, you get it in. You know, this is where you get to really see most clearly how a method itself, independent of the person's intentions, who, if the person is taught the wrong method of thinking, will be induced to go with an imperial policy. And you get it with the global warming fanatics. Because look at climate science in the 1950s and 60s, where it was actually investigating the role of cosmic radiation in having a direct bearing upon the cloud coverage, cooling, ice ages, which we know. I mean, it's pretty much directly evident by all physical historical records that all ice ages are caused directly at periods where cosmic radiation is not intense. Intense. Yeah, cosmic rays are intense. Because as you have the ionization of the upper atmosphere, you get more cloud coverage. And with cloud coverage creates a condition whereby the ice ages can, you know, the ice caps can grow to a threshold level where they end up overtaking the melting period, and, you know, you get these 60 million year, 140 million year ice ages.
Can you make that?
Not now. But that's a segue. I'm just saying a segue here. But the point being is that today, whereas people were actually looking at the real science behind global warming, behind global cooling, which is what it was called in the 1970s. Today, it's all just statistical models. So, all right, that was a segue. I apologize. Guys, hey, Vilmos, I can totally hear you. No. Okay, so anyhow, this brings up to the last character I'm going to be introducing today after one of the you could actually say associates in a certain sense, because he did know Einstein. And he was a student of Vernadsky, Alexander Derbich. He was a very, very much underestimated and scientist who was almost completely written out of the history books, though he probably contributed what will offer the most to human society's advancement and cures for questions like AIDS, cancer, and other things. He was the founder of a school today called optical biophysics. Optical biophysics. And what he discovered is that not only is there an interaction with matter and energetic phenomena occurring within the photoelectric effect, within non-life, but also within the atoms that are animated in life, specifically in atoms animated in life. And what he discovered were what are called ultra-weak photon emissions. So, what is this? He was at the time. The big question was how do cells mitosis, right? Since all cell divisions are occurring at a constant rate, and all atoms are going through a constant biomigration within every living organism, much like Bob's example of the whirlpool, where all water molecules are going into that whirlpool, which is sort of a singularity in a continuous process, and then leaving that whirlpool. But the whirlpool still exists as sort of a discrete idea within a continuous process. You could think of, again, right, living organisms as individuals, but also as species, are experiencing a constant influx of atoms, of carbon-14 being absorbed as we lose it, as it decays. And we have cell division. Now, I'll write that down. It's called mitosis. Yeah, that's one cell. Now, what governs that? Since our cells go through approximately something like 10 trillion divisions in the course of a day, I think. So it's a ridiculously huge number. And you've got something like 10 million cells dying on you every second, and you know it's there's a big turnover, and it's almost as if every part of your body has to, in a certain sense, have a certain connection with what every other part of your body is doing to keep this thing, to keep you, and not turning into some, you know, blob of fat and blood on the floor or something, you know. It's something which in itself can't be described by any reductionist, you know, molecular biological methods of just cells communicating information. What he discovered was that, and also I'll just point out, if it was occurring just like 1% quicker or 1% slower, your body would either explode or immediately entropy, and you would, again, be blob of blood on the floor or just dry bones. So there's a certain very important harmonic equilibrium that has to be maintained in all life. Now, he discovered using this famous, and I'll wrap it up pretty soon after that, but using what's today the famous onion root experiment, Gurvitch was able to discover, and I gave a quick class on this not too long ago, so you can watch it online to get something more in depth. But his proof, when he was hypothesizing, well, what was this means of communication, he took basically two onion roots in a very elaborate contraption and had them grow perpendicular to each other. And what he was able to observe was that the onion stem growing, it's called the meristem, that was growing downwards, was inducing a 30% to 40% increase in cell mitosis occurring on this stem. Right. And so I was wondering, well, what is that? Is it just some sound frequency? Is it what, you know? So he put two types of glass between it. The first one was a quartz glass. No, the first one was just a regular ultraviolet stopping glass, like a glass that wouldn't permit ultraviolet radiation. And when he put that glass on, the one that stops ultraviolet radiation, or ultraviolet light, indeed, there was absolutely no effect. So this thing didn't change at all. No increased cell mitosis. He removed that, put a quartz glass that now permits ultraviolet light to go through, and all of a sudden he discovered that mitosis still 30%. So he was able to hone down and discover 30-40%, yeah. And so immediately the implications are, okay, cells are light emitters. Every biological cell not just has, and also It has a certain electromagnetic field as well, which is a different, and that's every cell. But they're all emitting light. Now, this was the, I mean, Einstein was praising this. I mean, this was the center of a lot of research happening in the 1920s and 30s. And then it was shut down, with the excuse of World War II. And Gurvitch ended up finishing his life with a small group of dedicated students who weren't receiving any funding, doing all of their work essentially in one cold lab, and that was like the only laboratory in most of Russia conducting these studies. Now, this was almost brushed out of history, and you could look at who was doing the financing to crush, or putting all of the money in other layers of biology and research at that time outside of biophysics, and Rockefellers. I mean, mostly the Rockefellers. That was what was controlling a lot of the science funding then, as today. But this was almost dropped off and forgotten until the 1950s. You had a group of Italian astronomers who discovered that even with more precise instruments, they were able to discover that even corn and other grass and other things were emitting also light. Then it was dropped off a little bit, but not followed up with. And then in the 70s, you had Fritz Popp, who, with a grouping of scientists, discovered the active agent for what causes cancer, what carcinogen causes cancer in smoking, in cigarettes. And he basically rediscovered Gurvitch. He discovered he made an important discovery in the rate of ultra-weak photon emissions occurring within cancer cells, that they were much, much greater than just healthy cells that have a relatively constant equilibrium, I guess you could say. There's a constant sort of rate of emissions. So, cancer cells, you can see all of the graphs, they're just like astronomical, right? He was also able to observe that cells, when placed close together, come into a certain beat frequency together. Right? So there's a certain communication, and they're brought in lines. Much like as you'll find a mom with a newborn baby, their hearts will tend to beat in sync, or even clocks that you'll find in a clock store, like pendulum clocks. You could have them all going at different times, but come back in a couple of hours, and every single clock in that store is going to be moving to the same beat. And so this is, again, something that has to be very much explored much more seriously, because right now you just have fringe science that is taking this thing in different directions, and there's no really unified mission or method furthering this question. He also found a way to activate and deactivate cell viruses based upon narrowing down the very small spectra within the ultraviolet frequency that was able to deactivate E. coli bacteria. So that's something. Now,
What do you mean deactivate?
Deactivate, like the E. coli bacteria?
Doesn't kill it, what you deactivate?
Yeah, like it's not, it's like dormant, I guess. Yeah, it's not splitting, it's not dormant, it's dormant, it's not like, I guess, a dangerous thing at that point. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about it, though. These are questions which you can only imagine what, when you're accelerating life to relativistic speeds, and you're investigating, what is changing, what would we discover in regards to the biophoton emissions that would be at different rates if you're going that fast on another planet, in interstellar space where you're far away from the sun, and you don't have the sun's activity, which I didn't really go through, but the sun's activity to keep away the solar, the cosmic radiation. So that, if you're, let's say, in orbit around Pluto, then you're being bombarded with much more cosmic radiation flowing through you, and we're all being hit by billions of high-speed particles, neutrons, electrons, protons from other quasars, solar systems, galaxies, and that would be much more intense on the outskirts of our solar system than they would on the around the sun where it's nice and safe, or at least where the sun's the solar wind is keeping a lot of the shit away. So these are the types of frontier questions that need to be addressed. In terms of this bring this back to cosmic radiation, and I won't say too much on it right now, but we know that it's not only that this phenomenon, which is considered just like the current argument for Gurvitch's ultra weak photon emissions is that these emissions are so weak that they couldn't possibly induce such a complex process like cell division, which requires mitochondria DNA. It requires like such a complex process. Something so weak could not do that. So people generally who will admit that he'd made the discovery still don't admit that it has any relevance on the reality because, you know, whatever, it's so weak. The similar argument comes up right now as a block in investigating cosmic radiation. Because even now people are saying it's called a weak force based upon all of the energetic phenomena hitting the Earth, right? From the sun and everything else. The physical effect, the physical impact of cosmic radiation is not that observable in the immediate sort of, you know, when it's going through our body all the time. It's and so people discard it, saying, oh, it's so weak. It's a weak force, you know, but so is gravity. So would you discard gravity? We can know, though, and it seems to be implied that though it is the weakest, perhaps, amongst the forces, it does seem to have the greatest impact on the long-term cycles of what generates the change within the universe. And I have some interesting graphs which I can email any of you. But also we have a lot of articles which I've gotten some of these leads from on the role of extinctions, how you have huge decreases in different diversity species of fossils over the course of approximately every 60 million years. Ice ages, 60 to 140 million year cycles. These things interact directly with cosmic ray influx because what we're dealing with are variables like the, and this is how when LaRouche is when you're reading LaRouche's papers and he's, you know, emphasizing this question of thinking from the top or top down, not bottom up, is a good example of that, where this, you literally have to think about how long it takes the solar system to go through the southern part of the Milky Way galaxy, and how long it takes to how much time it spends on the northern part of the Milky Way galaxy, right? Because that we're dealing with about 60 million years or so. Similarly, how long does it take for our solar system to move through the arms of the galaxy? Right, we're not always in the same arm; we're moving through it, kind of like a car's caught in traffic. You know, the truck is really holding everybody back, like that arm of the galaxy is. But then people will drive by the truck, you know, get back on their path. That's what all those stars in our galaxy are doing. They're not all in the same spot, and this again has a very periodic quality to it. So it's with that, and this is where the cosmic rays are going to be consolidated. You know, there's much stronger gravitational attraction within the plane of the galaxy, not so much within the upper or lower limits. So when we go through that, you can imagine what effects is it on life, on the evolution of species, to be bombarded with such phenomena that we already know are major in transmutation of atoms. Causing carbon-14, so important to life, is a big example, right? If we weren't doing that, there wouldn't be life. What else is it doing? Right. And so, I think with that, I wish I could give a more satisfying sort of resolution, but these are the types of things that we just have to initiate for mankind, increasingly the capacity to make these discoveries occur. But I would leave it with also this idea of human beings, because as we are individuals, we do know, as you could say in a certain sense, we do have a certain particle-like quality to us. We are finite, we're discrete, you can sort of see the boundary conditions of us. Some go faster than others. But there's a certain finite quality, but yet we partake within a higher unfolding of a continuous process of humankind, of life as a whole, right? This is a principle of the universe. It's not just localized on Earth. So how is it that we partake within that unfolding within a self-conscious way? How do we self-consciously and willfully act, not just to develop others, but to fundamentally have the effect of developing ourselves in acting on the future? And that's, I think, what LaRouche is getting at in this last quote I'm going to leave it with here. This is from his new paper. Sounds a little esoteric, but it's not, called The Secret Economy. The characteristic feature of socially relevant human behavior is the development of human society through what are ontologically noetic changes in individually motivated mass behavior, as Shelley implicitly defines such a principle of human behavior in the concluding paragraphs of his A Defense of Poetry. These considerations then present us with two issues as interdependent. One, that the universe is creative in and of itself. Two, that the inclusion of mankind in that universe as being a consciously creative thinker and actor provides the additional unique factor of known willful choice lacking in other living species. The creative factor of what are to be distinguished as the specifically creative aspects of the human individual will, as subsuming the actual development of what may be otherwise defined as that universe. It is a quality which the existence of a developing set of individuals of humanity adds uniquely to change the universe as otherwise defined. That's just a short segment. You guys can read the rest on the web, on the LPAC site.
Thank you, everyone.
Sure.
Cosmic rays and something living being bombarded by this? When they have bombarded them?
We are already.
I guess we are a living experiment, but yeah, actually like a controlled experiment?
Yeah, you just see clouds.
No. Bob? Or Ilko?
Yeah, you have the
like what?
You know, you're treating with radiation cancer. So we think this is a radiation which is infecting living organisms. Mm-hmm. You can affect the rate of growth of our cell development.
Right. That's true, because what are you dealing with cosmic radiation, but it's essentially the same thing in a radioactive decay process.
In a selective
right?
way.
Yeah.
You're like selecting you're, certain cells.
Yeah. You, exactly. Like you have beta decay, like when you're dealing with a radioactive decay, you've got alpha decay and beta decay, which are positive and negative protons and electrons being emitted from uranium or whatever's decaying very, very fast. And so, yeah, that's essentially what we're organizing when we're giving people radioactive treatments to stop their cancers.
And are there not all those Danish scientists to make this experience with the cosmic rays and how the water
goes? Cloud
formation. Yeah, that's not in terms of life, though. I think that's more in terms of cloud formation. Because you can set up... There's experiments that we're actually going to do this week. Ilko just got all of the ingredients. So we're going to create a cloud chamber with some dry ice and actually measure some, or at least look at some cosmic rays coming out of our window at the office. So, yeah.